At the end for the last session of this little retreat, so one more question. Yeah, okay. January finger. So we'll just read out the questions at the result. If you have any more questions towards the very end, I'll also take those at the end as well. Or do you have any questions now? You want to ask for Lincoln? Ah, Lincoln, yes.
Yes, question, finally. The two concepts is such a huge body of teaching.
Yeah.
And I'm not sure during our last time that how much of the sutras we actually cover. Is there some system that you might be able to study the sutras in a more
okay. Yeah, that's I think that's a very important question actually. How can we study the scriptures for ourselves without feeling overwhelmed or too much and not actually knowing how to do it? It's a good question. One of the books that I have always recommended to people is Bhikkhu Bodhi's In the Buddha's Words, and I'm sure you know about it. And that is quite nice. It is really an anthology. It's a collection of sutras that we put together in a systematic fashion under certain headings and in a certain way. It's called In the Buddha's Words. And it's translated by Bhikkhu Bodhi. Bhikkhu Bodhi is probably the most well-known and the best translators of sutras into the English language. It's very precise. Sometimes it's a little bit too philosophical because he has a PhD in philosophy. So sometimes you read, you get big words, right? So you have Google next to you, can Google the words, and then you'll be fine then. But that is, I think, one of the best introductions to the sutras. Otherwise, what I can recommend, there also are good sutra readings available online. We do them at the Dhammaloka Center in Perth, and you can listen to those if you're interested. There are also other teachers around the world who do nice sutra readings. Bhikkhu Bodhi is one of them, and other people as well, and they're often very useful to listen to because it allows you to get access to the sutras in a better way. But always remember that when you are listening to somebody teaching you the sutra, right, remember that when I teach you this sutra, what you are hearing is not the word of the Buddha. What you're hearing is the word of me, right? So remember that. So sometimes when you read the sutra on your own, you actually read it slightly differently from when I read it. And sometimes you get other things out of it than what I say here. And that is an important thing to keep in mind. There is no such thing as just giving you the word of the Buddha. If all I did was reading it out to you, then it wouldn't be much point in me coming here, right? I have to kind of comment on a few things, but that means that I become the latest commentator. So sometimes you will hear monks say, oh, forget about the commentaries are kind of, you know, they are no good, it's not really the word of the Buddha, and then they give their own commentary, right? Wait a minute. It's what it's like. So we should be very careful with just dismissing anybody. There is a lot of good stuff everywhere, a lot of ancient monks have obviously said some very good things, and that is part of what the commentaries are about, so we should respect them. But the point of the commentary is more like, if it doesn't come from the Buddha, you are allowed to challenge that if you feel that in certain cases it might be wrong. That is really the right way of looking at that. So this is one of the delightful things about the Dhamma. I remember myself when I started hearing Ajahn Brahm giving Dhamma teachings, right? And he would read the suttas. And initially I thought it was very interesting because he also had a very good understanding of the suttas. But of course, after a while, you get your own understanding, right? And then you start arguing with Ajahn Brahm, right? And then after a while, he gets fed up with you because you're arguing too much. That's a good sign. There's always a good sign to challenge a little bit and not to, you know, to actually take things in our own way, understand things in our own words. It's actually very useful. So try Venerable Bhikkhu Bodhi's In the Buddha's Words. That's what I would recommend. See what happens. The paparazzi has come out and now Ajahn Brahm has warned me against the paparazzi. He said, oh, stop any pictures. Very good. Anybody else have any comments or questions about that or anything else? Okay, well, I'll move on to the sutras then, to the questions rather. Okay, here we go. Question number one. Hey Bhante, I am really new at sutras. As a beginner, can you please advise me on which sutra should I start? Is there a chronology to follow, given that after attending the Sutta Kampayu, I have a better understanding of it? So I just answer that attention, right? Number two, also different Bhantas have different interpretations of the sutra. How does one know who is right? I am right, right? Everybody thinks they are right. This is the problem. Everybody is sure that they have the right interpretation. But actually, to be honest with you, so I'm sure that many things that I have said here, which could be improved upon a lot. Every time I read the sutras, I read them slightly differently. There's different things I say. And sometimes I think, oh, I said that before. Why did I say that? That was a really silly thing to say. No, that doesn't happen often, but sometimes you feel that you have said something that wasn't quite right. The best thing to do is to, sometimes we find certain teachers that you feel you can trust, right? Because of their character, because you have observed them over a long period of time. And when you find somebody you feel you can trust, then use that initially until you are able to read the suttas on your own. It may be as a lay person that you never get to that point because it takes quite a lot of study to get to that point. And if you don't, just focus sometimes on those teachers you feel you can trust. One of the problems with using too many different teachers is sometimes it can get very confusing. But sometimes, you know, if you listen to a few, and then when you feel out who you feel you can trust, then you go with that. Sometimes you can ask the senior people in the BGF, this community, and they get some advice from them as well. And then gradually you learn, you start to get the feeling that is the right thing to do. Okay. May I know, is the Prajna Paramita Heart Sutra part of the Buddha's suttas? If not, would appreciate if you can enlighten us on the origin of this sutra. Okay, so the Prajna Paramita Sutra is one of the early sutras of the Mahayana tradition. And the Heart Sutra is like a short version, in a sense, of the Prajna Paramita Sutra. So it is like, it is the Prajna Paramita in its shortest form. Prajnaparamita sometimes is very, very long, very big sutta. And these suttas of the Mahayana tradition, they started to appear maybe around the first or the second century BC. So some of them are very old, at least the core of those suttas. And then gradually over time, they evolve more and more suttas coming from the Mahayana tradition. So they started to really come into existence at that time. The standard idea that you sometimes hear is that, you know, the sutras that were hidden in the dragon world until kind of people were ready to hear them and then they came out. I don't personally believe that sort of thing. To me it sounds too fantastical and too kind of obscure. Why would the Buddha hide sutras in the dragon world? It doesn't sound right. People weren't ready, but later on they were. People are just people, right? And it's, I don't think that this really works. So, and also when you read the suttas, the Mahayana suttas, they are quite different from the early suttas. We can feel very clearly they weren't spoken by the same person. Because the way they are phrased, the vocabulary, the style is very, very different. The early suttas have a very homogeneous style, they all have roughly the same style. Whereas later things, actually style is very different, vocabulary is different, the ideas expressed are different, they're often much more flowery, right? When you read the Mahayana Sutra, it talks about the million bodhisattvas coming together on Mount Golshapik. If you have been to Mount Golshapik, it's impossible to have a million bodhisattvas there. And then if you're lucky, you can clap together 100 or so, if you're lucky. It's a very small place. So it is a very different type of literature. I don't mean to say that it is all complete nonsense or anything like that at all. Some of it may be very good. Some of it may be based on real experience that people had in their meditation practice and all of these things. But it is definitely not the word of the Buddha. I think that, to me, is beyond any doubt whatsoever. So they emerge over time. Some people have suggested that it emerged precisely in this way, that people had meditation experiences. And some of those experiences may have felt that they were in the presence of the Buddha or something like that. And then they're just expressing what they felt, right? That may have been the origin of those suttas. Something like that. Nobody really knows for sure exactly where they came from or how they arose. Number four, I am confused about the concept of no self. Who or what then experiences the happiness, joy, once we go deeper into meditation and are able to see things as they really are? Okay, so this is a good question, and it's a kind of a huge standard question. Remember that it's not that you are getting rid of the self, that no self, there's no self afterward, but there is a self now. There is never a self then in the first place, right? So right now there is no self. So it's not when you come to deep meditation that something disappears. The only thing which disappears is the delusion, is the wrong view. That is all that disappears. Nothing, there's nothing actually which exists beforehand which disappears afterwards. So right now, it feels like there is self there. But the Buddha says, well, actually, it's just a misconception of reality. So you're not losing anything, right? When you see these things, all you're losing is just an illusion. And losing an illusion is great. To see things clearly is wonderful. Who doesn't want to lose illusions? It means that we are not really understanding things properly. So who is experiencing the feelings now? It is just this... this person who is not permanent, this impermanent person who is moving around, this is the person who is experiencing this feeling. You are still who you are, you're still the same person, nothing has changed. The only thing that has changed is that you have seen through an illusion. That is all. It's not a big deal. It sounds like a big deal because we're not used to thinking in this way. But actually, it's not really a big deal. You happy with that? Maybe, it's difficult to be fully happy about these things, isn't it? Until you see it for yourself. Okay. Dear Ajahn, I see myself as a lazy disciple, forgetful of the Buddha's teaching, fall asleep during Dhamma class, etc. That's good. It's good to fall asleep. You know, you need to sleep, that's fine. Are all these due to the five hindrances? Two, how can I be an effective learner in Buddhist meditation? Thank you so much. Is it due to the five hindrances? Maybe, it's hard. Maybe you are just tired, right? Maybe it's due to the five hindrances. It depends on the circumstances. And I can't really say. Sometimes you go to meditation class and you're just too tired to really take it on board. Maybe the teacher is a bit boring. Is that possible? But not so many people fall asleep when Ajahn Brahm gives the talks because everybody has too much too laughing all the time, having a good time. So it's also, I think it is important that the Dhamma is presented in a way where it engages people, we feel engaged. The traditional way of teaching Dhamma has often been too sleep-inducing, right? Because that's why you fall asleep so much, because the teaching is sleep-inducing. That is not so strange. And this is why I like to have a bit of interaction as well with the audience, because if you have interaction with people are more engaged usually. Is anybody sleeping here today? Can't see anyone sleeping. That's good, right? After the meal, somebody was looking a bit tired, but now it is much better then. So, yes, sometimes it is because you are tired, other times it is because of the five hindrances. Generally speaking, if you are able to abandon the hindrances, you will generally feel less sleepy. You will have less problems with the mind. The first two hindrances are by far the most important ones. If you can reduce ill will and those things, you will feel far less sleepy. Ill will usually creates sleepiness. So can desire, the sensual desire to some extent, because the mind is often very restless if you have a lot of desire running here, running there, and after a while you get tired because of that. So just by practicing the path in the right way, by having a good heart, doing the right thing, actually, just by doing that much, your sleepiness should already be reduced. So, how can I be an effective learner in Buddhism? Well, just, you know, one of the important things, you probably know what you have to do already, right? You have to be kind, you have to think kind thoughts about other people. You probably know about all of these things. And the most difficult thing in Buddhism is not to know what needs to be done. The most difficult thing is actually doing them, right? So, and to do them consistently, day after day, week after week, to persevere, to be really committed on this path, this is the hardest thing of all. So, to do that, one of the important things is that you need to inspire yourself quite regularly. Sometimes you run out of steam, right? Oh, I've had enough of this Buddhist teaching, right? Doesn't seem to be getting me anywhere anyway. Oh, I'm really fed up, okay? That is the time you need to listen to something inspiring here. And people inspire themselves in different ways. One way is to read the sutta. Not that many people can inspire themselves in that way. Another way is to come here to the BTN and take part in some of the activities. Another way is to go online and find a nice talk that might inspire you, right? Whatever it is that inspires you. But a general, a regular input of Dhamma teachings is so important to keep you on track, keep you inspired, keep you committed, to keep on persevering in the practice. So make sure you get your regular fix, right? You become a little addicted to Buddhist teachings. It's a good addiction, so you're fine. A little addicted to the Buddhist teachings, and then you will kind of carry on in a good way. Okay, some ideas for you, so let's see how you go with that. Okay. Dhyana, can you let us know whether you conduct meditation with Rikichana Grove? Which month and whether it's open to public like us today? It is open to everybody to attend, but like all our retreats, they are very popular, unfortunately. It's actually quite hard to get in. It's not quite as hard as Ram's retreats, but it's getting difficult. I only do one retreat a year normally, one 9-day retreat, that usually is in June. The one for this year is already fully booked. Somebody already asked me, and it's already unfortunately fully booked, and the waiting list has been closed and all that kind of stuff. So you have to be ready. You have to be very quick. I think on the website it says when it opens up for booking. So you have to be ready for the future. That's unfortunately how it works. And you have to be fast typer as well, right? I'm joking a little bit there.
But it's true, you know, Advan.
Yeah.
Then you have, if you really want to get in, you got to get the computer ready.
Yeah.
And if it's 6 o'clock, you got to get your computer ready at 5:45.
Yes.
Your meeting has started, so that you can get priority.
Yes.
And it's very fast.
Very fast, yeah.
It's true.
Exactly, yeah. I think we're at around it's like 3 minutes and everything's booked up. Yeah. So it is, that's true. Which in one way is great, that's wonderful and it's so popular. On the other hand, it's difficult for people to get the space, so it's kind of a two-edged sword, yeah. So, yes. There's so many things that we should have more of, you know, more retreats, more talks, more traveling. Ajahn Brahm, he gets so many invitations from overseas. He says no to about 4 out of 5 invitations, and then he says no to him because he can't travel. So you are very fortunate in a sense here at the BTN because you already have an established relationship with someone like Ajahn Brahm. Because of that, Ajahn Brahm is a very loyal kind of person. Once he has a relationship with somebody, he goes there, right? He's very loyal. So it means that you have that advantage. So hold on to him, right? Or you don't him. I'm telling you. He's so very, very popular around the world. And even I now, I have to say no thank you to invitation. I get you back as well. So it happens very quickly, right? So this is the reality is that life is too short. That's the problem. There's too many things to do. And you can't do everything, unfortunately. Yeah. So anyway, so that's just life. I don't know what we can do about that. Okay, next question. In Ajahn, is the Satipatthana Sutta there is mentioned, Eka Yano Mago, is Satipatthana the only way, as some would say? Thank you, Bhante, we met up. Yes, Eka Yano Mago is exactly what it said there, and it is one of those very controversial phrases. What exactly does it mean? Eka means one, Yano means something like going. It's actually Ayano, Eka Ayano Mago, the path. Going one, the one going path, right? That's what does that exactly does that mean? One going path. So this is the question. It does not mean the only way. If it means anything, it means the path which goes in one direction only. That's quite a different thing. The only way is the Noble Eightfold Path. That's the only way. Es eva mago. There is just this path straight from the Dhammapada. Es eva mago. I can't remember the whole word verse now. Atangi mago. Something about it. The Eightfold Path is the only path, it says the Dhammapada. That is the only way. Satipatthana is only one of the factors of the Noble Eightfold Path. So what exactly ekayana mago means? Well, I would say the most natural meaning is the path of the thing which goes in one direction only, right? So if you're practicing Satipatthana in the right way, it carries you towards the goal. But that is really what I think it means. But there are other suggestions about it. One of the interesting suggestions, this is from my friend Adar Sujato. He's quite controversial sometimes, because he's also a very clever person, very good at these other things that he does. And he wrote a long book called The History of Mindfulness. And it's basically a history of the Satipatthana Sutta. And his argument, the Satipatthana Sutta has been, in its original form, was quite different from it is now, and it has expanded quite a lot over time. And the argument that he presents actually is very good. And I think a lot of scholars would probably agree with that, because there are different versions of the Satipatthana Sutta. They're all slightly different. How come they're different? Well, one of the reasons is probably because it has been expanded over time. Long time ago, right? We're talking about 2,000 years ago, whatever. And one of the things that he talks about in this book is the meaning of ekayana mago. And he argues in this book that eka here, eka means one, right? Now, if you know about samadhi, one of the words for samadhi is ekagata. Eka, agata. Aga means peak. Eka is one. This is what is often translated as one-pointedness into English, right? Things coming together. So eka in Pali, or also in Sanskrit, has this idea of things coming together. Ekata is a word for oneness, and ekata is also a word for samadhi in the suttas. The oneness of the mind, right? Coming together. So what Adar Sujato, as I said, he's a bit controversial, and I think he enjoys that actually. So he says eka means samadhi. So the ekayana mago is the path that goes to samadhi. And that's what he says. Now, and this is very interesting. You may think that this is strange when you first hear it, but actually, if you look at the whole structure of the Buddhist path, right, you have the Noble Eightfold Path, and the Noble Eightfold Path is a sequential step, starting with the right view, going to virtue, then going to the right effort, then going to right sati, mindfulness, which is the four satipatthanas. What comes after right mindfulness? Right samadhi, right? So in the Noble Eightfold Path, it is very clear that satipatthana is really what leads you to samadhi. So that satipatthana should be the path going to samadhi, going to oneness of mind. It actually fits that idea very well. And this is something you see throughout the suttas. If you read the suttas carefully, this idea that Satipatthana takes you to samadhi is actually something that is found everywhere. Of course, the modern idea is that Satipatthana is about vipassana, or insight, right? That is kind of the modern idea. But and that may be true. I'm not saying that is wrong necessarily, but what I'm saying is that according to the suttas, the main purpose of Satipatthana practice is to get you to samadhi. Of course, vipassana can also take you to samadhi, right? So there's no contradiction there. But that is the actual purpose of this. So do I think Adar Sujato is right or not? It's very hard to say. I think probably he is not, in my opinion. Maybe it's very hard to say, but I think ekayana mago, at the very least, it means the path which goes in one direction only, or goes in one direction. The path which goes in one way, that is really, I think, the main meaning. It goes in the way towards nirvana and also towards samadhi. So there you are. Definitely does not mean the only way. That is one of those, I would say, mistranslations that they had in the earlier days, back in the 1970s or 80s perhaps, which is not really used anymore. Venerable Vicky Bodhi doesn't use that translation anymore, because I think he realizes it is not really appropriate. So, there you are. So that is a bit of a speculation on the meaning of ekayana mago. Yes?
Now, following your argument, is there any scholar might have a different thinking that this young girl leads to some other path or leads to some other direction?
What do you mean there? Yeah?
Talking about the
path,
the samadhi. So I just wonder, is there any scholar from the faith itself suggested otherwise or other things?
Well, I think that a lot of people who study the Sakapatthana Sutta will say that it is about Vipassana practice, right? It is about insight and these kind of things. And many people will say that. And very often the reason why they say that is because they base their study on the Satipatthana Sutta. If you read the Satipatthana Sutta itself, it is a bit ambiguous. Yes, they say that, but also based on the commentaries, based on many kind of other arguments. But to me, it is very... I don't know why they say that. I feel like the reason why they haven't said that is because they haven't taken into account the wider context of how Satipatthana is used in the suttas. If you only look at Satipatthana Sutta, maybe you can come to that conclusion. If you look at how it is used across the board in all the suttas, I cannot see how possibly you can do that. I'm not really saying that it is not about Vipassana, but I'm saying that if it is about Vipassana, the goal is still Samadhi, because which all you have to go through Samadhi to see things according to reality. Yeah. Okay. Dear Ajahn, could you kindly elaborate on the recollection of virtuous behavior in the Mahanama Sutta? Okay, that was the one that I didn't do. Okay, let's just have a quick look at that, since I have it here anyway. So the recollection of virtue. So this is what it says in the sutta. It says the virtue are unbroken, flawless, unblemished, unblotched, freeing, raised by the wise, ungrasped, and leading to samadhi. Right? So the first thing here is this idea that when you practice virtue, you know, you practice it in a very complete sense. You don't actually break them in any way at all. And that actually is probably a little bit of an overstatement. So you may break them occasionally, but if you do break them, you confess your transgression pretty much straight away. This is especially true for monastics, but even for lay people, if you feel that you've done something wrong and you want to kind of confess it to somebody, you can actually do that as well. So that is what perfection in virtue means in Buddhism. It doesn't mean that you're always 100% perfect, but that you actually will confess it straight away if you make a mistake. Yeah. They are freeing. This is Bujjhisa, is the Pali. Freeing means, and this is interesting because many people feel that they get restrained by the virtue, right? All these rules I have to keep. You know, what if I don't want to keep them? So the feeling is that you, instead of being free, you are actually being oppressed in a sense by all these rules. But the point is that you actually, in the long run, you get the mental freedom from these things. You get the freedom from the hindrances, the freedom from all these oppressive things inside of you. Right? Anger that you don't want to have is an oppression if you don't want to have it. Desires that you don't really want to have, if they come into your mind, it's oppressive. If you don't want to be tired and slothful and restless, when it still comes to you, it is oppressive. So what you are doing is you are eliminating all those things that actually oppress you inside of you. And by doing that, you're actually feeling a sense of freedom by practicing these virtues in the right way. This is why it is freeing. It seems like an imposition on you. Actually, it is freeing. It is praised by the wise, right? Isn't that great? Who cares if you are praised by all the scallywags of the world? It doesn't matter, right? If the mafia boss says that you're doing well, it usually doesn't really say very much. They are ungrasped, and this means, again, because we are here talking about the noble disciple, and the noble disciple is naturally virtuous. And because he or she is naturally virtuous, it means they don't have to grasp onto the rules. It just happens. It's become part of their psychology, part of who they are as human beings. They are just naturally good people. For the rest of us, you grasp a little bit, right? Otherwise, you're not going to keep them. So grasp a little bit, enough to keep them. That's important. lean into samadhi, there you are, right? This is kind of the really important one. That if you keep these things in the right way, this is what I've been looking at and saying all the way throughout. So, sila, which is kept in the right way, leads to samadhi. It's interesting, it doesn't say that about any of the other ones, or all the other recollections here. It doesn't say leading to samadhi. This is the only one. So, and one of the reasons for that is because these other recollections, fully understanding what the Buddha is, and fully understanding what the Dhamma and the Sangha are, you can really only understand it fully if you are a street manager, right? But if you are virtuous, it will lead to samadhi regardless. Whether you are a street manager or not, it will take you to samadhi. So this is a good thing. If you really practice virtue in the right way, it will take you to the deep meditation. Good news, isn't it? So all you have to do now is get into it, get in there and do it all the way. But remember that full practice of virtue in Buddhism is very profound. Avoid the bad stuff, do the good stuff, purify your mind, all of this has to come together, and then you're practicing it in the right way. So what does it mean that we recollect our virtue? I would advise you to be a little bit careful about kind of forcefully trying to recollect your virtue. Usually it happens quite naturally. When you sit down and you are peaceful and your mind becomes still, naturally the good acts you have done tend to come back to you. So if you use too much force on this kind of thing, it tends to destroy the meditation rather than working. You can guide your mind a little bit towards that and say, oh, let me think about something nice from the past, and the mind will take you back there. But don't be very gentle with yourself when you do this kind of things. Otherwise, it will be counterproductive. Okay, so there you are. So that is a brief one on the recollection of virtue. Okay. Dhyana, what is the four pair of person, the type, eight types of individuals about? Who is it referring to? Okay, so this is referring to the Aryans, the noble people, those who have a direct insight into the Dhamma. Four pairs are two types of stream entry, two types of once returner, two types of non-returner, two types of arahants, kind of. Okay, four pairs are, you have, let's just look at four first of all. Stream entry, once returner, non-returner, arahant. Okay? So these are, why is it called pairs when I only mentioned four? The reason it's called pair is that you have the one who is practicing to become the stream mentor, and then you have the stream mentor. The one who is practicing to become the once returner, the one who is a once returner. One is practicing to be a non-returner, the non-returner. One is practicing to become an arahant, and the arahant. This is how you have four pairs and eight individuals. Right? So eight individuals, right? And if you look in the commentaries, they say that the one who is practicing, he is only one thought moment before the one who has realized it. So that individual is very hard to meet, right? You have to be very quick because they realize it before they realize the fruit. So I would say that because it talks about eight individuals, it actually means that this idea of one person being only one thought moment before the other one, which you find in the commentaries, to me does not seem right according to the suttas. So there actually are eight specific individuals here. They're all noble ones. They all have profound insight into the Dhamma. And this is really the important thing. So that is why they are special. Yes?
Yes, I have a little difficulty trying to understand a person about two types of, let's say, stream entrant. The person who has now become a stream entrant, wouldn't he already be practicing to become a once returner? Because they separate the one who has achieved stream entrance from the one who is now practicing to become once returner.
Okay, yeah, that's a good question. And I think the idea there is that there comes a point when you have to become a stream entry. They call in the sutta, they call Dhamma Nusara and Sadhana Nusara. I don't know if you've heard about that. These are the people who have had such a profound understanding of the Dhamma that they will become stream entry in this life. They are guaranteed to become stream entry in this life. And then, once you are a stream entry, then you are perhaps you are practicing to become a non-returner, once returner, But what is meant is those people who are guaranteed to become once returners in this life, right? They are the ones that is meant. They are the ones who are practicing to become once returners. So after you become a streamer, it takes a while, and only after a while do you become one of those other ones. Well, you may never become that, right? Depending on your practice. The same thing for arahants, the ones who are practicing for arahantship means the ones who definitely will attain arahantship later on. But that is how I understand that. Okay, so let's move on to the next one then. Dear Ajahn Brahmali, since at a young age I have been able to regain consciousness in dreams occasionally, with that I could direct and manifest things in the dream at will. Yeah, this is a very common phenomenon, it's known. Lucid dreaming, that's why it's called lucid dreaming, that's right. At the same time, I could stretch the vision of the dream beyond the set of the dream. Okay, that's interesting. As I contemplate more and meditate more, these occurrences happen more often and with greater clarity and control. Would these, i.e. the regaining of consciousness and development in reducing the powerless meditation, be interrelated? Yes, I think definitely so, definitely interrelated. Your mind is becoming clearer, you have more control over these things. Definitely it means that. So really the lucid dream, usually this is probably what you are happening now. You know that you are dreaming, right? You are in the dream, but you know that you are dreaming. Because you are in the dream and you know that you are dreaming, you can take charge of that dream and you can basically go wherever you want and you can do all kind of stuff. This is what lucid dreaming is about. Is that what you're meaning? That you are aware that you are dreaming inside the dream? Maybe that's what you mean by this. So yes, that's good. So it makes very good sense that because of your meditation practice, you gain even more able to do that as a consequence. That is definitely the case. I'm not sure how useful it is, you know, maybe to have a bit of fun or whatever. I'm not sure if it really... Maybe you can go and see some great teachers, right? Maybe you can see the Buddha, that would be cool. Go try it out, right? See if you can get some really nice Dhamma teaching from a great teacher or something. And who is that great teacher who talks? It's just you. But you will be talking to yourself. And then you figure out how much Dhamma you really know, right? That'd be very interesting. Okay. So here we go. Next one. Ajahn, in the Tibetan tradition, there is always a strong urge to find Tulkus, the reincarnation of past Rinpoche. Is this not a form of craving by itself? Yes, possibly. I guess it depends why people do it. Maybe it is a craving sometimes, maybe other times it is not craving. I don't really know. But it could very well be a form of craving. It's hard to really say unless you talk to them, I suppose. If the ultimate belief of Buddhism is to end the cycle of rebirth, will this also not create a different situation whereby the mass of the population will then become ignorant again because there are lesser, wiser people around? Okay. Yes, that is possibly true, because those people who are really wise, they won't be there anymore because they will have disappeared. And this is why the idea of Buddhism is always to pass it on to the next generation. You pass it on to the next generation, they practice well, right? And then you get people who are stream enterers in the world. They may come back as human beings. And then they practice well, they pass it on to the next generation. So the idea is always to pass it on before you die. So if you're an arahant, it's good to teach others, right? So that the people, the Dhamma can keep on going in the world. But the problem is that it doesn't help if you hang around, right? If you are very wise, or if you don't practice fully, if you don't become an arahant, or you don't become a stream mentor, you don't really understand the teachings properly. So you can't teach very well then. So just staying back and just kind of hanging out in samsara is not going to be helpful either. We have to practice all the way to be able to be an effective teacher. And that's why it is actually arahants is one of the best things that can happen in the world, because they have their disciples and it carries on teaching in that way. Last one. Can a person with depression meditate? Sure they can. Usually that is no problem. Meditation can be very useful for depressed people. allows you to rest a little bit, allows you to, you know, take off the pressure for whatever it is in life, and it can be a very can be quite beneficial. Especially if you don't, you know, make it a relaxed and easy meditation. Just you enjoy yourself, just relax in it, but allowing yourself to be here. I think many people, they even in the health services around the world, they often actually use meditation to treat people with a depression. Here I am. I come from a traditional Chinese family that frowns upon their child becoming a monk or nun. More so if it is the only child, as it is customary for the child to take care of the parents in their old age. There was a case where a teenage boy committed suicide after strong objections from his poor, not well-to-do, as he struggling parents who couldn't afford to let their young son renounce, but wanted him to continue his education, get a good job, and carry on the family's small, struggling business. How would you advise the parents or the child before such a tragedy happens again? I think it is important, of course, for both the parents to listen to the child and the child to listen to the parents, to find some kind of middle way where everybody can be, you know, can function. Of course, if your parents really need you, then there is a, if they really, really need you, then perhaps you have an obligation to you know, to help them. But also, as parents, you have an obligation to ensure that your children are happy, that they do what they want to do with their life. So the obligation goes both ways, right? This is an important thing here. So there is one of the suttas in the Majjhima Nikaya called the Gatikara Sutta. This is actually about a non-returner. It's a layman called Gatikara. And he decides not to become a monk, even though he's a non-returner, not to become his monk because his parents rely on him. His parents are blind, right? So they can't really help themselves at all. They can't do anything. And without him, they probably would just die. So he decides, well, rather than just allowing my parents to die, I will support them in this life. So the same thing, it depends on how reliant your parents are on you. If they really do rely on you to survive, then yes, it is not a good time for you to become a monk, right? You wouldn't be very good anyway. Imagine that you go to the monastery, become a monk, and then your parents starve to death, right? Then you feel very guilty afterwards. So it's not a good idea. But then at the same time, I think it is very important for parents to listen to their children. If they have a very deep feeling of, if your parents are, it's good for parents to try to understand their child, because a child, if they have a very strong feeling that they want to become monastics, it is something very pure and very beautiful about that. And sometimes the parents, if they try to understand the power of these things, it is something which actually, if they get around that, they will be very, very supportive of somebody who wants to become a monastic. So both sides need to give and take a little bit, and when they do that, when people work together in that way, usually you can find a solution. So this, I think, is... So they need to talk, right? Child talks, parents talk. If they find it too difficult, come here to the BTM and try to find a third party that can kind of sit in between and listen to them and give some good advice both ways. And usually a solution can be found in that way. Very often, if there is a conflict between two parties, very often you need a third party to help resolve that conflict, because it's very hard to resolve otherwise sometimes. Yes, it is sad if somebody commits suicide because of that. Of course, that is, then everybody is worse off, right? Both the parents and the child. So, anyway, I hope that helps a little bit. So let's go on to the next one here. In Adam, my son who is still studying is a kind and assertive person. He does very well in his studies and gets along well with others too. My husband is always fault-finding and quarreling with him, saying he is unassertive, lacking in initiative, and sleeps in. I am in despair as my husband is affecting the family. What can I do to change his negative and fault-finding mind? Thank you, Anja. Take him here to the BGF, right? Let him listen to some nice Dhamma discourses, nice teachings or whatever. I think this is one of the best ways. Sometimes you need to find something in your life which gives you a clear guidance. Sometimes when you're a husband and wife, you're very close together, it can be very hard to tell your husband what to do, right? He may not listen to you, just like you may not listen to your husband, right? It's the same thing. So you don't listen to each other very well. So often you need, again, a third party, somebody who has another kind of authority outside, and they sometimes will be able to get through to that person. So, you know, very gently, maybe you can suggest to him, come along to some nice Dhamma talks or whatever, and then perhaps, I don't know if your husband is like that, but if he is, then perhaps gradually he will come around and look at things in a different way. I think many people are actually searching for a spiritual part of life. Many people live lives that are too materialistic and often they feel a sense of emptiness inside. And often people who come to the spiritual path, they actually feel uplifted. And they will feel, in the long run, they will feel very grateful to you if they actually, you brought them along and taught them something more profound than just the ordinary things in life. This is what I think is happening in the West to some extent. People are kind of giving up on Christianity, but they feel a sense of emptiness. We need something else. And a lot of people, for that reason, are turning to the Buddhist teachings. Try very gently to bring him along and see what happens. And then gradually, perhaps, he will start to see life in a different way. So this is perhaps my, at least one way of doing that. Okay. Go a little bit faster. Dear Ajahn, can animals also understand the sutras? What can we do to help the beloved animals have a good rebirth? Thank you. You can try take the sutras back home and read them out. see what happens. I think you will probably, they will probably just walk off because they get so bored, right? So I think the best way to help animals have a rebirth is to be kind to the animal. Because when you are kind to other beings, they feel often good inside. And when you feel good inside, good qualities arise to the surface, right? This happens with us. If people are kind to you, good qualities arise in you. If you are very kind to your animals, you look after them properly, good qualities will arise inside them. Then they will probably possibly have a good rebirth in the future. It's amazing, usually it's very simple things, right, that allow us to do allows these things to happen. And often we don't have to look all that far to find the solutions to these things. Okay. Please, yeah.
I remember the sutta, they say that there are a lot of beds in the cave where the monks are chanting, and then this time when they are reborn, they...
I think sometimes you have to be careful, you have to distinguish between the actual word of the Buddha and things which are like stories, right? Because lots of stories in Buddha. Buddha is full of stories, but very often those stories are not the word of the Buddha. And they're more like stories, they're just stories, nice stories, right? But you cannot really rely on them for the truth. And this is possibly what I would suspect is one of those stories. It's like the Jataka tales. The Jataka tales, very important tales in Buddhism, right? Massive, you know, six volumes full of tales. And these are often the things that you will hear in traditional Buddhist countries. They will tell you Jataka stories. But they are just stories. They're not real things. They're not actually taught by the Buddha. And the message may be nice, may be inspiring, but you can't trust them in quite that way. And there are stories in there of the, you know, one is the story of a monkey who offered some honey or something to the Buddha, and he was so happy, straight away he went straight to heaven. But it's a story, right? There is not actually something that you can really rely on as the truth. So the bad listening to chanting to become reborn as a human being. Maybe, I don't know, it sounds a little bit suspicious to me, but I, you know, we think sometimes strange things happen, so it's not entirely possible there. Dear Adam, if during meditation we are noting the pain becomes very uncomfortable. Can we shift our positions? You not only can, you must shift your position. I order you to shift your position. I think it is very important to shift your position. Personally, I don't think the noting the technique of pain works very well. Unless your mindfulness is incredibly powerful, then maybe it can work. But for most people, it doesn't work. So, by all means, shift your position. That is by far the best thing to do. Remember, as I was saying on the first day, it is all about the middle path, the Majjhima Pratipada, that's what Buddhism is. And of course, one extreme is to torture yourself. And if you sit with pain all the time, that's like torturing yourself, right? Don't fall into that trap. The idea is for the body to be neutral, neither indulged nor painful. When the body is neutral, the body becomes irrelevant, and then you can focus on the mind, focus on the breath, or whatever else. This is really the right way of doing things. So yes, please shift your position. Imagine, when our karma strikes us and makes us suffer, how can we eliminate our past bad karma? Please advise. Don't eliminate your past karma, because it is impossible to eliminate your past karma. There is so much of it. There is so whatever karma is there, the karma is there, and allow it to. Sometimes things must ripen, and that's okay. What you have to do, according to the sutta, the word of the Buddha, is to create good karma instead. If you create good karma, the experience of bad karma from the past will be lessened because of that good karma. Right? So that is really the right way of going about things. So you just live the good life, do all the right things, and when you do that, things from the past will have less bad effect on you. Very often we talk about things as if they are bad karma. A lot of the things that we experience in life are not really due to karma. They are just life, right? If you get reborn as a human being, if you lose your job, if your wife or husband walk away from you, if somebody dies when they're young, it's not necessarily bad karma, it's just life. Sometimes life is like that, right? This is what happens in the human realm. So because of what happens in the human realm, these are things that you have to deal with. So to make those things more bearable and less difficult, to create a good mind for yourself, create lots of good karma in this life, but as all the difficulties, you will be able to bear with them much better as a consequence. So do all of that, and then you'll be okay. There's a famous simile in the sutta, the simile of the grain of salt. And the grain of salt says that the grain of salt is like the bad karma that you have made, right? A lump of salt, that's the bad karma. If you put that lump of salt into a glass of water, the water is here the metaphor or simile for the good karma that you have made. Put that salt into the water, it becomes very, very salty, or you can't drink it, it's so bad. So the karma is very strong, you feel a lot of pain as a consequence. If you take the same amount of salt and you put it in a large pond and you drain, you can't barely taste it, right? It's barely there. Because now you have made so much good karma that the bad karma is not really able to reach you in the same way. So you are diluting the karma from the past by living well in the present. The idea that you have to eliminate karma is a Jain idea. It's from a different religion. It doesn't really belong in Buddhism. And Buddha never said that we should eliminate bad karma. We should dilute it and move in the right direction. Yes. Okay. Well, usually what happens is that when you have a tradition like the Buddhist tradition, as soon as you know, as soon as the Buddha dies or whatever, you know, people want to write other things. They want to continue the tradition. So they start writing commentaries on the suttas. Oh, we don't really understand the sutta properly. What does it actually mean? So you write a commentary on that. And then you start to say, well, the Dhamma isn't really complete. The Buddha hasn't really explained all the points. It is not a complete philosophical system. Right, it is complete, you better make it complete. So you create the Abhidhamma. The Abhidhamma is an effort to complete the Buddhist as a philosophy. And then there is another aspect which says that, well, there are all these stories here. You know, these stories are nice, they have kind of a Buddhist idea. Let's collect some stories and call them the Jatakas. Initially, everybody probably knew that it was the word of the Buddha. They were just stories that were used to inspire people, that were collected, and they were a bit like a commentary or a bit like an additional thing. And gradually, over time, they became more and more accepted as a core part of the Buddhist teachings. This is what often happens, right? When the founder of the teaching dies, people start to think in different ways, they spread out in different ways. One way is the kind of the scholastic movement, the academic movement, where you create the Abhidhamma. The other one is the popular movement, where you want to teach people about Buddhism in a popular way, so everybody can understand. That is like the Jatakas coming into being. The Jatakas probably started to come into being quite soon after the Buddha, within maybe 100, 200 years of it, they started to come out, and eventually were collected into the Jataka texts. Originally, it was only the verses of the Jatakas, and then you get the expansion of the stories and things afterwards.
So there isn't a single author to the Jatakas. It's just a collection from various sources.
Yes, it is probably just a collection from various sources, and some of those sources, many of those stories are stories that existed in India prior to Buddhism. So they were like stories that, you know, people were telling you. And then they became also Buddhist stories as a consequence.
Yes, bring me also to the same question about the Dhammapada. Did the Dhammapada go through the same thing, or it actually is specifically taken as the word of Buddha?
I think the Dhammapada is a complex situation. I think many of the verses there actually go back to the Buddha himself, because many of those verses are also found in the four Nikayas, yeah? But some of the verses are not found there, so probably it was also expanded at the same time, right? So the little bit which is from the Buddha, a little bit which probably is later, yeah? It's a mixed bag. Yeah? Same thing with the Sutta Nipata. Some of it is very early, some of it is later. So it's like, yeah, complex.
So,
yes?
Which part of the Sutta Nipata is later?
Well, I think the most original part of the Sutta Nipata is the Antakavagga and the Parayanavagga, the two last chapters of the Sutta Nipata. They also exist in the Chinese arguments. And that's one way you can know that they're quite ancient. Most of the other suttas don't exist in the Chinese arguments, as far as I know. So they're probably later editions.
Thank you.
Yeah.
Similar question.
Similar question.
I was going to ask whether there were any suttas that was actually not spoken by the Buddha or his immediate disciples.
Any suttas, you mean, which, where?
In the four Nikayas.
In the four Nikayas. Yes. There probably are some suttas that have been maybe at least changed a little bit or edited a little bit or you know, have a slightly later feeling to them. I would say the answer to that is yes. And usually you can know that because they actually have a different feeling to them. There are many indications in the suttas that actually are later on. One of those suttas that I think is later is called the Anupada Sutta, Majjhima Nikaya 111. And if you look at that sutta, there's a lot of kind of strange things in there which don't fit with the early suttas. And you have to have a feeling about it being a later edition. It does exist in the Agamas, Chinese Agamas. I'm not going to go into it now, but it has many aspects to it which are late, I think. Okay, I'll quickly go through the rest of the questions if that's okay. There's only a few left. Yes, not too many. From Madhyama Nikaya 20, the removal of thoughts. Please let me know if I go too far over time or whatever, because I'd like to keep the rules, whatever the rules are. So, removal of thoughts. What's the difference between trying to forget thoughts and trying to still the thought formation in a practical sense? Okay, so the forgetting of thoughts is really, I think we discussed that before, it's not so much about forgetting it, but it's about shifting your attention away from that thought. Right? So if you are sitting, you're meditating on the breath, a thought comes up, you shift your attention back on the breath and just let sort of thought kind of disappears in the background there. Right? And that is one way of doing it. Another one, if you have a strong thought, this is about the thought formation, a thought comes up in your mind, when the thought comes up, you just observe it. Right? And if your power of observation or mindfulness is very strong, the thought will start to die down because you're observing it until it disappears completely, slowly dying away. Then it's gone, and then you go back to the breath again. So it's similar, it's quite similar, but it's there's a slight difference there in how it works. So. Okay? Okay. Conditions look good for me to join the novitiate monks program this year, but I have not been practicing the Noble Eightfold Path very well. My fear of the head shaving came up even as I filled in the application form. But how can I prepare my heart and mind for this program in the next few months before the program starts? I fear meeting friends and colleagues again with a bald head, even if with a beanie hat or a wig. Does it defeat the purpose of renunciation? It's cool to have a bald head, right? Remember that it's cool to have a bald head. And, you know, if you go and visit the nuns with a bald head, it actually looks quite nice. I think it looks quite, you know, it's not a bad thing to have a bald head. And as you said, you can have a wig, right? So find yourself a nice wig and put that on, and then it won't be such a big problem anymore. These things, I think, it's much more the fear before you do it that is the biggest problem. The actual doing it itself, it turns out, is not such a bad thing. If you want to do something nice, like joining the novitiate program for the nuns, then do it and put those fears aside. Things will work out one way or another. You will find a path of dealing with that fear of meeting your friends and colleagues afterwards, and you will be fine. Don't take it too seriously. The step of you know, becoming a novice nun is not as big as you think. It is not that hard. You know, I've been a monk for 20 years. It's not that difficult to be a monk, you know. At least, well, now I guess I'm used to it. I can't remember anymore what it's like to be a layperson. So, it's not that hard. It's sometimes people think, oh, it's incredibly difficult. It's so incredibly hard. It isn't that very, very hard. If you have kept the 8 precepts on retreat, it's only one little step more than that, and you will be fine there. So don't worry too much about that. Just sometimes you have to take little risks in life, right? If it is a risk to do something good, you will be doing fine. You won't have any problem at all. So just jump into it and see what happens. Just enjoy yourself. Have fun. Don't worry too much about what other people think. If we allow ourselves to always be pushed around by other people's thoughts, we'd never get anything done in this life, because we just allow other people to control us, basically. So don't do that, because life is too short to do that, basically. So good luck and have fun. That's my main advice to you. From Anguttara 339, the delicate one, to intoxication with health. Does this mean total disregard for health when a person is healthy, or overly concerned about oneself when ill? It basically means to be overly concerned about health. Please don't completely disregard your health. But it means more like to be so obsessed about your health. Yeah, I'm healthy, right? I'm never going to get ill. I feel really strong and whatever. And I can just go out and do bad things as a consequence. That's really what it means. Right? It means the sense of delusion, of intoxication, of lack of clarity that arises in your mind when you feel, wow, strong, right? No, I'm never going to be sick again. And then you get sick. Oh, something is wrong with me. It's not right. No, it's right. Something is right with you getting sick. So that is really all it means. Please don't disregard your health. Of course, you have to look after yourself. Otherwise, you won't be able to do the practice properly. Okay. When there is no rebirth, where are we? Western paradise, outer space. which part of the galaxy? Please advise. If you want to go to another part of the galaxy, you have to have rebirth, right? So the way to get to the other part of the galaxy is to have a very strong intention. May I be reborn in other part of the galaxy? So you get reborn there. So this is one way of doing that. Western paradise. Why Western? Why not go to the Eastern paradise? That'd be even better. Western paradise is one of these Pure Land ideas, right? Western paradise. So that is kind of Mahayana Buddhist thought of outer space. Remember that the point here is not to get reborn, so you don't go to any of these places, right? This is kind of the point here. So the point here is that as long as you get reborn, wherever it is, even if it is in the Western paradise, you still suffer as a consequence. Rebirth is suffering, said the Buddha. No rebirth is happiness. So that is why you head in that direction. That is why the best definition of nirvana, people often ask, what is nirvana? What exactly is it? And the best understanding, it is the end of suffering. It is the highest happiness. Nirvana, paramam sukham, said the Buddha. Nirvana is the highest happiness. That's good enough, isn't it? Don't you want the highest happiness? That is what it is. Okay. Dear Ajahn, thank you very much for very inspiring and profound sutta sharing. I have learned and understood how sutta should be read and understood. As rebirth takes place again and again, I understand it is important to practice and serve our parents well in this very present moment. And from moment to moment, I am able to be aware of how the conditions of mind arise and cease before it reacts. With much gratitude and appreciation. Thank you. Okay, that is a very, very kind of you to say all those things. So I'm glad that you have learned something, and hopefully other people have as well. That's great. And that's also one of the reasons why I like to teach these things, because I too learn something every time I teach this retreat. So it's good for everybody, which is great. Okay, so second last question. Dear Ajahn, while reflecting upon death, will it make death come true? Sometimes there is this mental energy will cause some perceptions to come true. Please advise. Thank you. No, that I think it is the other way around. I think if you reflect on that, if you do it in the right way, it has to be in the right way, right? It has to be in the way that you feel peaceful, you feel relaxed about things. Always, if you do any spiritual practice in the right way, it usually makes you a better person. It makes you more able to deal with things. It could step off. You usually get a longer life, right? Sometimes when people have a bad illness like cancer or whatever, or heart disease, whatever it is, and meditate, actually, it makes them better sometimes. Meditate in the right way, and they overcome some of those problems. So usually the spiritual practice, whatever it is, even reflection on death, instead of making you die quicker, it makes you die slower. So, last question for this retreat, I think. So, I understand that the awakened mind is one of the ways to overcome the blocking of the deluded mind. How to practice constant mindfulness, awakened mind from day to day. Thank you, Adana Sadhu. How to practice constant mindfulness. Cannot do, it's impossible to have constant mindfulness. It is not something that you need to focus on, constant mindfulness. If you try too hard to have constant mindfulness, you will become very tense. Just be mindful all the time, right? It's very hard to be mindful all the time. And the reason why it is very hard is because in ordinary life you are so busy, you're running around doing things, too many things demanding our attention, constant mindfulness is virtually impossible. What you should do, instead of trying to be mindful all the time, you should try to put into place those conditions that give rise to mindfulness. That's one of the things that we have been looking at during this retreat, is remember that virtue, sila, is what gives rise to gladness to the mind, gives rise to energy. It is also what gives rise to mindfulness. So if you practice virtue, if you practice sila, if you practice kindness, that will ensure that your mindfulness is at the maximum level at all times. So focus on the kindness, focus on your heart quality, focus on overcoming those negative states of the mind. And when you do that, then when you go on retreat, you find that mindfulness every year increases a little bit. Don't try too hard to be mindful in daily life, because some you will not succeed in that. It's basically impossible to be mindful absolutely all the time. And so, but you have enough mindfulness to be able to observe your conduct, right? Enough mindfulness for that. It's not a very high degree of mindfulness, but it's enough. And enough for that, and then you can guide yourself in the right direction. Okay, so that was a little bit over time. Is there anything else? Everybody okay? Everybody exhausted? Okay, so great. So maybe that's a good place to end the day.